Hey, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We're rhetoric warriors breaking down the rhetoric out there, helping all the good people win against all the bad people. We're cleaning it up. That's our job. Complicated times, man, that require sophisticated techniques. So let's see if we can get some of that. I am Dr. Dan. I'm an American rhetorician, escaped professor, late night comedy writer. I do comedy and I do rhetoric. I'm the founder of Rhetoric Warriors. Pop over to Rhetoric Warriors or follow us on any of the social media. I write jokes all day long. I just turn politics and important things that are serious to people in their worlds into jokes. So the podcast has three purposes. I talk to comedians about their politics. We have fun with that. Those brains always have a perspective. I sometimes convert conservatives because I think that's interesting to me. I haven't been around that many conservatives in my life, and I'm fascinated by it. So it's fun to talk to them about what they believe. And I glean mad persuasion advice from rhetorical types. My main claim to fame with this podcast is I have more rhetoricians on this podcast than any other podcast in the world. Number one, amount of rhetoricians, and also other persuasion pros. So this week, my guess is, I mean, he does everything. I don't know how to categorize him exactly. Definitely comedy, definitely a writer. He's an author. He's a playwright. He's a screenwriter, speech writer, teaches writing at the graduate level. Does PR, kind of runs a PR writing program, which makes him a de facto rhetorician, whether he wants to be or not, and does stand up. So everybody welcome, you know, tell this guy to slow down a little bit, but welcome Mike Long.
Oh man, Dr. Dan, what an intro! I've never heard dilettantism described so positively. I love it.
Come on, you do it all. You do everything.
I know more than you do everything. You're a late night comedy writer, for Pete's sake. You've written for the bigs over and over again. You've been on stage. You're a professor. My resume shrivels like a sad man in a cold pool.
No. By God, you win. You win the resume wars.
I'm just glad to be
before we get started. You know, like, it is funny, like, when you spend your whole life trying to build up credibility, trying to get jobs and trying to, you know, look good online so that you can sell things and stuff like that. And then when you actually have to use that stuff in real life, you look like such an asshole. It's like, oh yeah, great. Anything else you haven't done? What can you do? Real life is not real life.
Yes. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be anywhere. I'm glad I get to do a variety of things, just like you.
And you're at Georgetown right now, right? Is that your...
That's right. I've been there for 12 years, actually. I guess maybe a little more. Wow. I teach in the School of Continuing Studies there, which is the professional programs, among other things. I teach... in the master's program there, I teach public relations writing. I've taught speech writing, which is what brought me to Washington, actually, was speech writing and kind of what is our connection here today, one of several. I teach at Georgetown, and that's something that makes mom proud, so I get that in anytime I can.
It sounds
great.
Looks
good on a resume.
Like anything associated with D.C. and you're in there doing professional work, I mean, that's a solid piece of credential right there.
It's all right. I mean, I say that to acknowledge what you're saying as true, not to say that it actually has a great deal of value. It's just another city that happens to have a particularly wasteful industry built into it. I mean, it's the Silicon Valley of doing nothing. It is
an interesting city. Like, I've been to DC many times. I did stand up around DC and I did the DC Improv a couple of times. Just there's a different energy about that city. And maybe it is, you know, just like you said, like it's such a weird industry that's right there that you only get like in, you know, you get kind of in capitals and states around the country, like Austin, where I live, has a little bit of that, you know, with its crazy legislature, but it's everywhere in DC. It's just, you know, it's thick with it.
When I first came here, I would go back home to Southeast Missouri where I grew up. And they'd say, oh, you're back from D.C.? And then they would ask a political question. The first question is not, what do you do? They just assume there's kind of a connection to politics. Now, there was for me, but I was writing speeches. But still, there's as soon as you say D.C., I guess it's like Silicon Valley. You could own a chain of burger stands in Silicon Silicon Valley. I'm like, what do you think about AI? I don't know. I'm flipping meat over here. So,
yeah, get some of that AI up here in my meat flipping, so I can get
AI in my meat flipping. That's like my license plate. That's pretty good.
I love the fact that, like, coming from places like, you know, like you're from Missouri, I'm from Kentucky originally. You can't get rid of that. Like, you can effete yourself as much as you would like, become as erudite as you want, and you can always drop right back, you know, parachute right back into, yeah, Louisville, Kentucky.
It never goes away. The town I grew up in had 14,000 people, and then we moved to a town with 500 people. Thank you. So
500?
500 people. It was a wide spot in our farming community, Matthews, Missouri. I think you're exactly right. You don't shake it. And a lot of us, now I can't speak for you because you talk about Louisville, and I think of Louisville as Cleveland, you know, as a city. And I'm talking rural South for me. And there were years in my life where I really wanted to shake that. I didn't want to know part of it. I didn't want to go back. Sure. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. And then as time went on, I was like, oh, these people are everywhere. There's no bad thing about this. This is just different like anything else. I put away that hostility and that embarrassment for pride. It's like, yeah, it's just another place. It doesn't have all the advantages of some other places, but every place has advantage and disadvantage. And I did what I wanted to do, and that's all that matters.
Yeah, it always makes me think of that Don Henley lyric of that, you know, that same small town in each of us.
Yeah.
You know, that it's all in there. And like, I know I can trigger it in other people, like when I meet them. Doesn't matter where they're at. Like, one of the cool things about living in Hollywood as a comedian and a comedy writer is that all the stand-ups from all over the country eventually move there. Mm-hmm. So I knew more people from the South in Los Angeles than I ever knew, you know, anywhere else. There were hundreds of comics, you know, who had moved from all those areas. And so it's always right there underneath the surface. Yeah. I remember I was talking to a guy one night who was a producer and developer for Worldwide Pants, David Letterman's company that I worked for a while. And we were talking, and he said, he goes, yeah, well, what I find, and this guy was young and stupid, and so he was perfect for management in Hollywood. Yeah. Like, what I find is, like, all the good comics come from the coasts, you know, like the ones that are really useful are from either, you know, New York or LA. I'm like, yeah, you know why? Because all the middle has moved out there. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard anybody say. Nobody's born in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Yes, yes, and yes. And you know, it kills me, Dan, that I've lived in Washington for a quarter of a century, and I never envisioned that, and I hate that I'm a local now. I mean, you come here and you go, and I came here and I stayed, and I'm fine with that, but I don't like, oh yeah, I've been here a while. I never wanted to be that.
Why do you do that? Well, I think it's a badge of honor. I mean, I'm kind of fascinated by that place. Maybe it's because I like to look at politics from the outside. I don't like to live inside of it, but
I loved politics so much for so long. And then I think I saw that it didn't bring me any kind of bone deep happiness. And I thought, life is so short, and I don't want to spend my time chasing something that can be erased with the stroke of a pen by the next guy in. And I mean, I think these things are important. These are talking about how people, the quality of people's lives. We're talking about equality. We're talking about whether people can move through the day in a fair and just way. These things are very important, obviously, but I can't do that much as an individual except affect the world around me. I didn't mean to get all serious, but I mean,
no, mix whatever you want in here. Like, I think that's exactly right. You know, this idea that politics, you know, I don't think it gives many people joy. Like, it's sort of like, people don't even know this about, like, Hollywood. Most of the people who work in Hollywood, even though they're in entertainment, are horribly unhappy people.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. Everybody's always bitching and grinding and can't get this and can't get higher and being mistreated. It's a very unhappy industry. And I get the sense that politics is like that too. Like you said, it doesn't bring people joy to be in it.
Well, you know, maybe it does for some, it doesn't for me. But the thing that brings me joy, and that word joy I use absolutely unapologetically, because I dealt with severe depression, anxiety, for years and years of my life. And I remember the first time I saw a psychiatrist, he's like, so let me get this straight. You're doing stand-up and you have panic attacks. And I said, yeah. And he goes, okay. but if I'm not seeking out joy for myself and other people at every moment, I don't feel like I'm where I ought to be.
Yeah, I love that word. That's one of my touch words. I like joy. It's just one of those unadulterated. How do you talk down joy? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Why would I want to? Why would I want to be mean to anybody? Why? I mean, even if they have opinions that I don't like, why would I want to hurt them back? I don't want to hurt them back. I want to be the guy that people think of and go, "Oh, Michael, help you." And I'm not anywhere close to that. I don't think. I hope I'm close, but that to me is like, that's the thing in the distance I try to keep my eye on. And I am such a shit person in so many ways, but at least I kind of have an ideal I'm shooting for.
But that's great. I like that line about thinking of Mike. Oh, he'll help me. Is that what you said?
Yeah. I'll call Mike. Well, Mike knows. Michael, give me some help. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a great. Like I've often said that I think when you die, what actually happens is they just count up how many times you walked away and somebody behind you muttered asshole. And that's what you get judged on. That's the whole thing. How many muttered assholes you got in life.
That sounds like a bit. That's actually very good. That would be a bit. I'm not holding myself up as some saint. I am not saying that at all. I'm just saying that I'm happier. It's pure selfishness. I'm happier when I don't try to say my job is to change the world. I just want to be good to the people around me and see what happens. And if everybody did that, the world would change.
Sure. Yeah. If you're not, you know, like you're aware of your effect on other people, you're aware that, you know, what you offer other people and you take responsibility for that, then that's a fairly, you know, workable social and personal philosophy. It seems like it would work for both. It would work well for the community and it would work well for you.
Well, it's where persuasion begins, which is one of the things, because you can't, I always say, I have a big slide I use in my lectures. I say, nobody ever won an argument that started with, hey, stupid. That just doesn't work. When I was trying to come to Washington, Ben Stein was a great supporter of mine. So friendly. I just wrote him out of the blue.
The actor Ben Stein?
And we spent many, many, many evenings together and with his father, Herb, who was a brilliant economist. And Ben was a real mentor to me for over a decade.
That's a great touch point. Ben Stein, he's such an interesting character, you know.
Fascinating. There's who you need to have on your podcast.
Yeah, I would love to. He looks like a fun guy to talk to.
He's fascinating. And he said once to me, he said when he was a boy, he went up to his father and his father had some important job. And he said, my dad turned from his desk and he looked at me and he said, yes, Ben, what do you want? And Ben said, I told dad whatever it was. And then it was trivial. And then I said, why would you put down your work to talk to me about this nonsense? And his father said, what more important thing could I have to do than to talk to my son? And that was just like somebody hit me with a brick. I thought that is a way to live for sure with your children. But you're sure with everybody, just fucking be there, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally, I like these little philosophy tidbits that you're throwing out.
I'm just trying to stay happy. I mean, I spent years struggling against just a lot of bad feelings. And
well, you know, and I think, you know, part of I said like in the beginning here, like one of the things I do with Rhetoric Warriors is I talk about converting conservatives. And what that really means is that, you know, on all sides of the political spectrum, because I have a daughter who's a hyper millennial, right? And, you know, and I think that's kind of a psychological disorder space to live in these days. I think they're overactivated and, you know, they can't control their triggers and that kind of stuff. And that's not healthy. Yeah. And I think the far right, I think, is the same thing. They can't control their triggers. And whenever I see that you're not in charge of your own emotions, like they're just rushing in on you and you can't control it, then I kind of have the feeling of I know things that would help that person. And so I try to reach out over there and I'm like, okay. And I have, you know, millennials and talk to them too. I do this with my daughter all the time, but it's because I know I can offer things because I have been taught these things. You know, that's the cool thing about getting a background in communication. And I have a background in interpersonal communication and then rhetoric, which is, you know, actively using language to transform people. And it's not to win something for me. it's because I see that pain and I'm like, well, it's playing out badly, I think, in some ways in our society, but it's really playing out badly for you. You can't tell me you feel good being this triggered all the time.
Well, there you go. I think, you know, I don't think it's isolated to any one group. I think there's an ease we seek. Forgive me while I totally go off here.
Yeah, do it.
I think there's an ease we seek in trying to put things in boxes. It's very easy to see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and say, well, that's the left, and to see Donald Trump and say, well, that's the right, or whoever it is that you see as the worst example, and then to call them the center of the thing. And that doesn't help. I learned this from, we were talking before we went on about our friend Lawrence Thomas. And Lawrence has been my friend for over 3 decades.
Shout out to LT.
LT, yes. In the MB, the Manhattan B.
That's right.
And OBs behind the BAR. But one of the things I've learned from Lawrence, and I don't think he's ever heard me say this, is we disagree about a million things. But I'll say, well, what about your side believe in A, B, and C, or my side believe in C, D, and E? And he'll go, I don't believe that. And it's like, oh yeah, I'm dealing with a person, not an ideology. I mean, if I'm anything, I'm closest to an anarchist, and I'm not saying that for a humorous effect. I very much believe the answer to every problem ought to be more freedom, not less.
Uh-huh.
And when you try to,
well, and who would argue against that, really?
And that's
like,
why
who would ever say, yes, take my freedoms away? Like, I love the contradictions in American culture, like all the way down from the very beginning, you know, half British and half, you know, wild tribe or whatever. But like, the
wild tribe, that's my favorite scotch, by the way. It's very cheap, it's always on sale. They don't even put it on a high shelf. You just, can I have a wild tribe? Oh, yeah, it's one of you. They get to be a brown, right, man.
And so it's like, you know, it's this dual pull of, I don't want anybody telling me what to do. I think I can take care of my own life. I want as much freedom as I can ever get. And I also don't like the way those people over there are acting.
Exactly. Which is a disease of both left and right. And as the sooner we acknowledge it, the sooner we can go on.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me. Like, I never did politics. You know, it's only like the last 4 or 5 years because I was a comedy writer and you have to write about the dominant things of the day. All of a sudden Trump pops up and becomes 90% of every single day. And there's no way of getting around him. He was a cultural current event news juggernaut. And so you have to start writing it. And the more I wrote it, the more I started, you know, getting into the political, you know, sort of tentacles of everything. And I always kept an awareness of politics, but not at that level. And then I started, you know, looking at the stuff and going, okay, I can't just write comedy about this. I can't just watch it. Everybody keeps asking me, you know, rhetorical questions. And I'm like, yeah, rhetoric has answers to all this stuff. Like, if you want to counter Trump, if that's your desire, yes, rhetoric will show you how to do that. But it was never really my thing to go in and bring those lessons forth so they could use them. But then I was like, okay, I'll do some of this because I just sort of see all the energy and, you know, desire for it and kind of need for it in the world. So it's been fun, you know, going back into my 2,500 year history with rhetoric and just yanking things out and going, here, use this one.
Well, I'll tell you, I think I want to make sure people know this about you, and correct me if I'm smoothing an edge that needs to be rough. But obviously you're very clear about where you stand, but you can write from any perspective. You wrote for Dennis Miller. For Pete's sake. I mean, you can write, you find the humor wherever it is. And that takes an extraordinarily open mind to be able to write something that's funny, that takes on all comers. And that's not easy to do.
Well, I think one of the things you get in academics, and certain minds are like this, that you realize if you keep going through academics, the one true lesson that all real academics learn is that they're probably wrong.
Yeah, that's it's so funny you say that. When I teach persuasion, and this gets kind of the topic we sort of headed out toward, is I say, you can't engage anybody unless you're willing to say at the very beginning, I might be wrong. Now, you don't have to believe it with your whole heart in any way, but you have to be able to consider the possibility. I mean, if you're a Christian and you say, you have to be able to say, well, maybe there's no God. Maybe there is one and he hates me. Maybe there is one and her name is Allah. I mean, you got to be able to say that shit before you can engage in any deeply serious way. And that's not taught in my experience.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, yeah. Like everybody wants rhetoric tactics from me. And so it's fun to pull these out because a lot of them are comedic too. You know, comedy is very tiny mechanical devices that you just use over and over again, like tags. So I love to do tags as comedy and I love to do it as rhetoric, especially like tagging an aphorism, you know, like where people are like, and I grew up Catholic, so I know Christianity really well. And I was Catholic kindergarten, Catholic grade school, middle school, all male Catholic high school and Catholic college. So I got some Jesus, you know, down. And so people will,
I saw the collection of Bibles there on the shelf behind you. So
yeah, yes. I'm not saying, you know, I think I got it. I think, yeah. You know, people are like, are you Christian now? I'm like, no, Jesus had his shot. Like he had plenty of time and access and he blew it. You know,
we'll call your agent. That was it.
Yeah. But tagging little things like that, where people are like, well, you know, God has a plan for you. And I'm like, well, that doesn't make it a good plan. You know, that's that counterpunch comedy that if you teach people, you know, it's not necessarily, it doesn't need to be brutal and it doesn't need it, but it engages, you know, and keeps the dialogue going. When somebody makes a very concrete statement. And stand-ups always got a way to go back in there and go, well, I'm going to dislodge that for you.
Sure. Well, you mentioned that I'd written a book, and that's where this fits in. I wrote a book with another Dr. Dan, actually, Dr. Dan Lieberman. He and I have been friends for years, and we wrote a book about dopamine. It's called The Molecule of More, available wherever fine books are sold, coming out and just released in Japan. We're in 11 countries, 10 languages. Okay, commercial over molecule.
All right, no, hey, commercials are great.
I know, but I just...
Commercial anyway. As much as you want.
There you go. Well, as long as we're at it.
Hey!
The one of the things we write about is that there's a biological desire driven by the neurotransmitter, the chemical in your brain, dopamine, to seek new things. And why would that be? Well, in fact, you get a really good feeling when you see something new and potentially promising. Why would that be? It's because you need certain things to survive that aren't immediately around you. You've got to, that may be a place to get food. That may be a place to get sex. That may be a place to get shelter, whatever it is you need. And all these new things naturally attract us. And people who have high dopamine are even more attracted to those new things. Now, it turns out people who have high dopamine also tend to be more creative than other people. Now, why the hell would that be? Here's why. Creativity, by one definition, is assembling things that aren't normally associated. In a word, dissonance. So people who are highly intelligent can also be highly creative because they're drawing in new things. And that is a long way around making the case for being open to everything that comes along, because you never know what's going to be dissonant in contrast to the things you know now. That's a quick neuroscientific tour of creativity.
Yeah, I think that I describe it a lot of times to people as, that's all I do all day long, is I go around looking for little intellectual heroin hits.
Sure.
Finding something new, like I'm doing, so I'm finishing up a book and I'll also do like a stand-up version of it. I've done a few of these one-person shows now. And this is the first time I'm going to turn it into a full book. But what I do is in the mornings, I'll write on the book and, you know, it's fairly intellectual work. And then I reach a point after 2, 3, 4 hours, I can't do it anymore. So I go work out. And then in the afternoons, I do comedy or I, you know, connect with people or do podcasts or stuff like that. And like yesterday, so the name of the book is Invincible Persuasion. Yeah, it's, you know, just the word invincible, right? It gives you a launching point in the stand-up. I'm like, yeah, it's a little risky calling anything you do invincible. You know, ask people in the Titanic. And I started researching the Titanic, and you know, 3 hours later, I'm deeply into the Titanic, finding out that, you know, three dogs survived on the Titanic. Who needs to know that? Well, you're gonna know it because I'm gonna do stand-up about those dogs.
There you go.
But it's something that I deep dive and found all the interesting little nuggets. And those are little heroin hits of information. And that's why comedy is so useful for that.
It is comedy, and it's useful everywhere. When I finish, I have a speech writing seminar that I teach, and I get to the end of the whole thing. It takes a couple of 3 days, and get to the end, and I say, just get smart in you. Anything that's interesting, just draw it to you and explore it, just like you said. And maybe the time will come when you'll be in a conversation or you're writing something and you can pull that thing up.
Yeah.
And then it may be that never happens. Either way, you had a good time. You're setting yourself up to be better at what you do. This notion of pulling things in. And like, I this joke comes to me. I know you know this bit is Bill Hicks, the great sainted Bill Hicks, who his birthday, in fact. Anyway, Hicks said Christians wear crosses. He said, you think that really makes sense? He says, you know, like having Jackie Kennedy wearing a rifle pin. That's the kind of dissonance that makes comedy to me. And it takes a certain kind of stones to go that far out there.
Yeah, there's a linguistic philosopher named Kenneth Burke, and he's got a term for that. It's called planned incongruity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing. It's like when you can crush two things together that have never been crushed together before.
That's it.
Then you get this sort of intellectual little tiny, you know, old faithful geyser just going bam, and you're like, ah. Oh. And that kind of instant release of that surprise and emotion and everything is what stand-up lives on, you know, that you can give people those things constantly.
I want to ask you a question in that realm. A lot of doing stand-up is figuring out where the edges are. You know, I'm going to ask, do you feel like this is an overstated threat right now? That, oh, well, now stand-up is really kind of hamstrung because if you get up there and you screw up by going in the wrong direction, you're canceled. Or do you think that on the whole, this is worth doing because we're making a more equitable world or something else? I mean, what do you think about how the sensitivity attached to words affects the ability to do real out there comedy?
Well, I just watched this morning Bill Maher's little rant over the week going on cancel culture. You know, he's trying to cancel culture. And cancel culture has become, you know, the kind of, you know, it's a very loaded term right now.
Means what you need it to mean that day.
Yeah. And, you know, people have always been sensitive. It's just, you know, it seems like we're getting extra sensitive. The judgment is fast and the judgment is harsh. The punishment is harsh, yeah. You know. And with stand-ups, I think part of the problem is nobody has adjusted to this digital universe that we've created. Nobody understands it. Mm-hmm. There's so much in there to explain our politics right now, why you can spread politics so fast, the idea of social media. Like you and I are sitting here doing a podcast. How long has it been since we've talked, Mike? You know,
I was thinking this morning, I was thinking when I first met you in person versus when I'd met you online. And yeah, this is crazy that we're sitting here like this.
Yeah. And, you know, we're instantly, again, familiar and nice flow of communication. There's no, it works, right?
It's crazy how easy it is.
So unnatural in human experience.
Mm-hmm.
This is an unnatural thing that's happening right now.
That's right. That's right.
And so like the cancel culture being, you know, the idea of criticizing people for, you know, there's correct criticism for people that are outside the bounds of our moral structures in this culture, right?
Of course.
Like the KKK clearly has been canceled for a long time.
Right.
Or attempted to be canceled.
That's right.
Most people have agreed, hey, we should cancel those guys.
Yeah, you know, yeah, you were Norm MacDonald there for a minute, I hope you know. Hey, you Klansman, that's not cool, you can't do that.
God, I love that guy. I love Norm MacDonald. But now it's getting, you know, moved out into the digital space and nobody's got control over it. So what does it mean that somebody, you know, three people who we've never heard of are going after Andrew Cuomo right now for sexual harassment? You know, what does it mean that like Al Franken got nailed for, you know, putting his hand on somebody's hip at a state fair? You know, is that fair judgment? Who knows? There's no way to know. What's happened with stand-up though is because stand-up is breaking out of its little space there, like you're pretty safe in a comedy club. If you piss somebody off, they leave.
Right.
A walk in the room.
I've had people walk out on me. I am proud to say chased people out of a room.
Everybody has. I've had a woman who was just sitting there in the middle of the show once, and I was like, "What's the matter with you?" And she goes, "You're boring." And I'm like, "No." I said, "Let's all take a moment and say what's really happening is you're stupid. Like, you're not getting any of the jokes, and therefore you are bored. I get it, but that doesn't mean I'm boring anyway."
I got to tell you this break in. I was in Jackson, Tennessee so many years ago. I'm doing this thing. It's a one-nighter. And I'm doing this stuff. And this lady stands up, tears streaming down her face, and begins shouting at me after her husband walks her out. Blasphemer, you're wrong about the Lord. It's like, I didn't think I was doing any religious material, but wow, it was a real point of pride. I was proud.
Yeah, to get I would love to be called a blasphemer. God, I wish. I've seen so many, you've seen so many times, every comic has seen people go off.
Yeah.
Sometimes weirdly, sometimes you understand it. Like, I was at the Largo in LA one night when Mark Maron was on stage and was having a terrible set. And Vonnie was like, "Okay, I'm going to get out of here. But first, I'm going to do just to punish you people, I'm going to do my suicide bit." And this guy, Frank, goes, "No, you're not." And Maron's like, "What do you mean? What? What did you just say to me?" He's like, "I don't want to hear this." And Maron's like, "Well, you're going to hear it." And the guy's like, "My brother committed suicide like 3 weeks ago. I don't want to hear this joke." And Maron's like, "I'm sorry, buddy, but I'm doing it." And the guy's like, "No, you aren't." And he tackled him on stage, just took him out. And that was the end of the show. And Maron's standing over talking to Janine Garofalo afterwards. And I walked past Mark and I'm like, "Hey, man, best closer in the business." So everybody, comics have experienced extreme audience and, critical reaction, and often physically acted out. You've seen it. We've all done it, verbally acted out. And now the rest of the world's getting to see what it's like.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because I only did stand up for a short time. And it's crazy how it never, let me brag for a minute. I wrote the liner notes for Seinfeld's documentary, Comedian.
Nice.
And I
got
a call.
You ended up doing that.
I wrote an essay that ended up being published in some think tank magazine about my own experience with it. And the whole point was that I don't know if this is true, but I wrote it as if it were true. I said, if you like this even a little bit, it'll never let go of you. And I said that I quoted Colin Quinn when someone asked him, "How do you know when your set is ready?" And he said, "When every joke kills and you're absolutely miserable." And I knew what he meant. Yeah. It's like there's nothing left. Having it work is just the point to get to the next thing, to write the next thing. And I can never, however long I live, I'll never not want to do stand up. But and now I've forgotten what I was going to say.
Anyway. Well, you started with liner notes that you wrote for Seinfeld, and
yeah, and the thing I'd said in there is that it never lets you go. But I don't remember where I was headed. Now I feel like a dummy. Oh, well, maybe.
No, I interrupted you. I made you talk about the liner notes for Seinfeld. We were talking cancel culture, and you said you always would want to do stand up no matter what.
Yeah. Yeah. And I said in those liner notes, I'd written this essay, and I got a call from the producer of the film, and he said, "We're putting the DVD out." And Jerry and I'll never forget. He said, "Jerry and I say you're the only person who wrote about it who understood it." And so that's the only notes. It's only up here on my wall. The only
nice.
Notes that are in the thing.
Great.
But I guess the point there is that if it's in you, you can't let it go, and you have this desire just to keep pushing out on the edge. I wish I could remember where I was going. I'm sure it was brilliant, but
I'm sure it was. Well, you said Colin Quinn like works on the jokes to the point where then he's miserable. Like, I think stand-up, we were talking about that the safety of stand-up has always been that it's an intimate space, small audience. They get to make their decisions about what they like and what they don't like. They can leave. You're fully free to leave. And what's happened now is the audience, I think because of digital universe and social media creating this multi-log, it's not even dialogue, it's multi-log. You're now, talking to 1,000 people at one moment. And the audience feels empowered to have a turn, that they should somehow be allowed to speak And like when I do digital media and social media and things, I don't give them that turn. I don't want to hear them.
Yeah.
You know, it just, it's too much. I can't be in authentic dialogue with people I don't know, especially at that level. So, you know, I think standups are now getting pulled out of their safe space, which is what standup was designed for. And it doesn't sound the same in the big culture. So it's not fair to judge it like that.
That's really smart. And I hadn't thought about the difference. It's like, because it's funny because comics talk about this all the time. In my day, they did, when it was, oh, well, that's a room that has a high ceiling. Be some bullshit excuse like that. But I mean, there are differences in rooms.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And to suddenly say, well, the way I can be very intimate and edgy in front of 200 people in this room versus what I can throw on Twitter. Yeah, that'd be crazy to think those are the same space. I never heard that, Dan. I'm going to use that. That's good.
Do it. Yeah, I remember there's a great comic, Roger Rittenhouse.
Yeah.
Out of Denver, and just, you know, great one-liner comic and just so super smart. But, you know, just loves taking things to the edge and will say, you know, a horrific joke about whatever ethnic group. And he has, you know, saves built in of, you know, like he'll do a, you know, Hispanic joke and be like, hey, if there are any Hispanics here, God bless you. You know, I love your culture. And, you know, but then he's always got the, you know, he's got the metal hook. Instead of a hand, so he can always just hold up his hook and go, I can say things like this, you know.
Hey, that makes me wonder, what's Bobby Slayton doing these days?
Good question, man. You know, I think really, like, the bar goes up when you get outside of your little space and you want to do something in actual public. The bar goes up for the quality of the writing and the quality of the comedy. You can still talk about anything, but it better be very well crafted. You know, yeah. I think Bill Burr shows like super craft on very edgy topics, and he gets away with it by intellectualizing, right? Yeah. There's so much intellectual backbone to what he's doing. You can't argue, if you went down the syllogism of what he's doing, you would agree with every statement getting to the joke. And so it gives him some safety, you know, and I think that I see a lot of shock comics use intellectualism to protect themselves, you know, on their way to their alternative point.
Well, I think you're exactly right, which is why I mentioned Bobby, because Bobby Slayton stuff, unless his act has significantly changed, I mean this in the nicest way. It ain't nothing intellectual about it. It's
total
Todd Rickles for the next century. Yeah. And it's very, very funny.
It's so artful. But I'll tell you, the other thing about him is he's correct. He finds the truth about someone.
Yeah.
And that legitimizes him. I saw him walk four women at Charlie Goodnight's one night because one woman had kind of sneered at him or said something. And he's like, she started it, right?
Yeah.
And then he found the truth about her and she got incensed and left. And he's like, okay, one down, three more to go. And he went after each person at that table. You know, but it's that perceptivity and finding the right thing about them that's their little, you know, their weakness.
This is wholly off the subject, but and you have so much more experience than I do, so maybe you've seen this before. I remember being at Zany's in Nashville one night. Hicks is up there, the great Bill Hicks, and it was a small crowd, and they never got Bill in Nashville. They never understood him, and this woman in the back, a couple of drinks in her, and she shouts out something like, well, let's go screw, or I love you. And he goes, okay. And he drops the microphone, walks into the room. You know, it's a small room. Walks back, grabs her by the hand, walks out the back door at the kitchen. And you hear that thing go clunk like that. And everybody's just standing there. And it was one of the most wonderful moments in my comedy library of memories, is Hicks just
awesome. Walked.
I remember Lenny back there like, well, is he coming back? Because you didn't know. You didn't know.
Oh, that's great. I love stuff. Comics, just so surprising in the way they approach that stuff. So you did a bunch of stuff with, like, working for politicians. I've written for a lot of comics, you know, and I know that kind of rhythm. You know, I know, you know, what they're after. I know I can very quickly figure out what their strengths and weaknesses are. But a lot of it's, you know, therapy. Like, I have to work them through the bit because they're afraid of saying this, or they're going to look bad if they say this. And
yeah,
I haven't really written speeches. I've done a little bit of speech writing for people. I've taught speech writing, but you've done that extensively. Would that be similar, you know, to working with a comic?
I can only tell you what I teach and believe, and mine varies significantly from what a lot of people think about how this works. As a credential, I can tell you I'm the resident writing coach for the Professional Speechwriters Association. So there are more than a few people who buy into what I say. I don't think that the speaker matters that much. A well-written speech, I could show you a speech right now and I could tell you five different people and say, I wrote this for them. And you'd go, it sounds just like them. Because people don't want to sound like themselves. They want to sound like a very clear version of a great speaker.
Right.
So then you say, oh, well, that's not true, Mike, because I like to tell stories. I like to tell jokes. Every Christmas tree is the same. The difference between my Christmas tree and your pagan Christmas tree is that you have the different tinsel in a different place. And yeah, but our trees are basically the same. It's the same thing with a speech. If you're a guy who likes, I like to open with a quote and I like to close with a joke. Fine. I can hang that on your tree. That's no problem. Speeches are about hitting expectations that are psychologically so deep, you're not even aware of them. And the example I like to use is when I go to a movie, I don't feel like it started until I see a title card. And there are things that happen in a speech that you could, because you're a rhetorician, but not the typical person on the street. They couldn't say, well, I don't know what makes a speech. I just know when I've heard a good one. There you go. I know what those things are. And that's what I teach. There are certain things that have to happen in a certain order. And then there are things we can do inside a structure that makes people follow more happily.
Do you feel like it's getting, because again, like I said earlier, you see the digital space come up and communication changes across every medium and every platform and every distribution center that you have. Is that working back now onto speeches? Is it breaking, media theory would say you get new aesthetics with your new mediums, like Twitter, 134 characters or whatever it's been. And now it's allowing a little bit longer and things like that. But you end up, shrinking things down, soundbiting things, Twittering things, Instagramming things so there's a good image with it. Is that working back into speeches right now, like this oral format speaking?
Yes. And it has been for since I first came to Washington in the 90s. Absolutely, it's there. And it's best understood as a diminished ability to sustain interest on the part of the listener. And to say that's good or bad is to kind of miss the point. That's just the way it is. And so you have to work around that. You have to work within it. So yes, the short answer is yes. The practical answer is there are ways to deal with it other than just cutting everything down to a soundbite. One of the things that I preach when I'm talking about speech writing is you have to hold their attention. That's the only thing that you should focus on when you're learning to write speeches, because there's this belief so many people have. I'll tell you, I gave this seminar at the Hay Adams Hotel, right across from the White House, in fact, many years ago. And I said, you have to write like nobody cares. If you write as if nobody in the audience cares, you'll be fine, but you got to assume they don't care. And she threw her hand up and she goes, well, Mr. Long, this is not true. I say very important things. I said, I didn't say it wasn't important. I said, they're not going to listen just because it's important. Well, we went back and forth around this for a few minutes. Finally, she got up and left, took her bag, left. I didn't care. I had her money. No, but I mean, that's such a terrible, but she's never going to be good at this because right. She doesn't understand. Your first job is listen to friggin' me. Okay. And once that's there, you can do it. And as for maintaining this attention without having to go to short, what you can do is you can say, look, I'm going to talk about these things, bang, bang, bang. You throw a map into the back seat with the kids and you tell them to mark the signs as you go past. If you do that as a writer, speech writer, you can get beyond this. Everything has to fit in a 15-second soundbite. You have to be cognizant of the lack of, or the profound and frequent presence of distraction, many of which just exist in your head. And that to me is the big secret of speech writing in this world today.
It's fascinating because I've always taught workshops and stand up, and for a long time it was always two people who wanted to do stand up. And then I realized that's not really who needs to be taught this stuff. They can go out, you know, and do it in clubs and practice enough where they kind of intuitively, you know, informally pick up a lot of the techniques. It's the people who want to learn, you know, underlying stand-up techniques who don't want to be stand-ups, who need to cross, have these techniques harvested and brought over into their world. And so, like, I taught a course in crowd work. Crowd work is how to riven an audience in the moment, how to create while in the moment. And then the other part of it is how to be interesting. Like, stand-ups know that, you know, any boredom whatsoever is death.
Yeah.
So they have a myriad of tiny techniques to force people to listen. And they don't, and people don't even know it. Yeah. You know, and when I'm doing this class, when I'm showing people, I'll be like, I'll walk up and sometimes, you know, in the middle of my stand-up, I'll just look at somebody and then I'll just go right back to the show. And you can just see it. They're like, why did you just look at me? And you've just activated that person psychologically for, you know, probably the rest of the show.
Yes. Yes. I believe that the heart of, boy, I hate to intellectualize it this way. So forgive me. If you need one word for stand-up, that word is dissonance. Everything is dissonance. Every punchline is dissonance because it's surprise. Every time you have to get somebody's attention back in, you're yanking them out of the moment with dissonance. When I give lectures at school or a seminar, I'll be talking about some technical topic and then I'll just stop and I'll say, my favorite late night show is Mannix. And I'll talk about Mannix for a couple of minutes. They're like, where the hell did that come from? But I got them now.
Yeah.
And so I think you're exactly right that this notion of keeping them there with something that they didn't expect to yank them back in, whether it's a glance, whether it's a word, whether it's a gesture. If you got that, then and I think I'd love to hear your response. I don't think the material has to be as good if you can do that too.
Yeah. There's, you know, I'm like you, I intellectualize all this stuff. And then when I teach it, I break it down to something I can use to explain. And I have like four power centers for stand-up. And then there's a bunch of like probably maybe 20 other kind of side fuel cells, but it's either the script, right? So the script itself is thick with jokes, it's thick with surprise and emotion and all that kind of stuff. And it's a character. You know, who's the character up there? Like, yeah, we were talking about Lawrence earlier, and Lawrence is just a wonderful, beautiful character. He's just a warm human being. And he just, when people, you know, meet him, they know that he likes them, you know, and that's just, that's wonderful. And then it's performance, just technique. And like stand-ups learn all this technique, like how to stay in contact with, you know, 200 or 300 people at the same time.
Yeah.
And then, you know, finally it's connection. It's this ability to create real connection with human beings. And when you put all four of those together, there's all sorts of opportunities to, like you said, you call it dissonance, I would call it stimulation, to stimulate the audience. And when you are the stimulation source, people just, they just lock on you. I sometimes describe it as like, I can be more interesting than your cell phone. Like, I know you're thinking about your cell phone because it's a massive repository of stimulation, but I can beat it, you know? And that's your challenge these days. It doesn't matter if you're a teacher or a preacher or a politician or anything else. You've got to beat that cell phone.
Yeah.
Which is a whole, you know, set of criteria for stimulation that most speakers have never really had to deal with.
Tell me this forgive that this sounds a little effusive. As somebody who's thought about this technically, what makes Mulaney so good?
John Mulaney?
Yeah. I mean, maybe you don't think he's that good. To me, I think he's the best we've had since Seinfeld, actually.
Interesting. Yeah, I wouldn't call myself a fan, but I think he's a very, very competent stand-up. There's a couple of things about him that, and I really like to go in to look at stand-up to see what they're actually doing, you know, on the kind of myopic level that's what's making them work.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. What is he doing? It seems to me that, I mean, just to say very quickly, it seems to me his stuff is so precisely written. There's not an ounce of fat in it that he doesn't have to do. He doesn't have to mug. He doesn't have to run around. He doesn't have to take a drink of water. It's like he's reading it almost.
Yeah, he's a very technical writer for sure. And Seinfeld was too. Seinfeld was a hyper writer.
Yeah.
You know, like I watched Seinfeld after he got super famous. I would see him every once in a while at the Improv in Hollywood, and he would come in and work on things. And, you know, it wasn't the same impetus like the real impetus a lot of times for stand-ups is that they're poor and that they're, you know, starving to death and they're trying to write the bit that will, you know, yank them out, like, you know, Gaffigan's Hot Pockets, multi-million dollar marquee bit.
Yes, you might be a redneck. Remember before that, he had this big bit about dragging a boat. Remember Foxworthy's bit about dragging a boat behind you? That was his big closer for years.
Yeah, but, you know, those stand-ups, you know, starving stand-ups constantly look for those things, and they work so hard. And so, like, script writers, I think Mulaney is a good script writer, and I've watched some of his stuff on Saturday Night Live that he's written for some of those other guys, some of the bits. Yeah. And some of it's like, almost Hicksian kind of lilt and, you know, use of, you know, terminology and flow. He's a really good script writer. As a stand-up himself, I think early on, I think there was a boyishness about him and an irony and an appropriation of nostalgia with that kind of suit and that sort of, you know, almost 40s radio delivery guy voice. Hey, you know, and so I think it had a melded character there. I think that's drifted as he's gotten more popular. And he's now assuming that people like him instead of working to make them like him.
Right.
And I don't like him.
No, okay. Well, that's cool.
I don't dislike him, but there's not enough there. Like, Brian Regan, I think, is the ultimate person to make people like him.
Oh, you know? Is there anybody to even compare to that?
But even Brian, now that he's gotten older, and I think a lot of his, he's been doing it so long, it's become architecture. Like, he's not as likable as he was before. It doesn't look as authentic. He looks worn out. And so it's that character thing, man. It is so, you know, it's so subtle about whether it's going to work or not. And Mulaney just has never really gotten me on character level.
I hadn't thought about the character thing hardly at all in my whole life. And that opens up some thinking for me I want to do. I want to mention Amy Schumer as well. I saw her for the first time cold. I'd never heard of her. I saw her open for Jimmy Norton, and because I'd come to see Jim Norton. Sure. And she was 10 minutes in, and I thought, I'm not sure Jim can follow this.
Yeah, she was a great stand-up. She really was.
I mean, I think of somebody like Beth Donahue, who I haven't talked to in years and years and years. And I was expecting something like that. And it was like, well, if you took Beth, I mean, Beth, and God love Beth. If you're listening, Beth, hey, how you doing? You don't remember me, but you're cool.
Great comic. Yeah.
Yeah, a great comic. And then it was Amy Schumer had taken that. And I was like, well, what if I rate it just absolutely fucking filthy and then just owned every second of it? That to me was Amy Schumer. And I was like, wow, she blew me away. She still blows me away. I think she's wandered some from what she does best, but wow, another great, great personality.
Yeah, and it's unfair to hold stand-ups across their whole career to the zenith of their career.
Yeah.
It's so hard to stay in that space where everything's working. You know, it's just exhausting. You know, you start making money, you start having a life, you start doing acting and things like that, and it falls away. Patton Oswalt isn't what he used to be, you know. But you see some guy like Andy Kindler, you know, who's done a bunch of stuff in the industry, but he's mainly been a stand-up. Mm-hmm. You know, he hasn't been pulled totally away from stand-up as his, you know, main avenue of life. And he just still kills it. You know, so it's interesting. Like, when I try to harvest from stand-up and pull it over into either business, like, I work in a lot of marketing now, and I still write for people and try to even, like, do kind of, you know, rescue some of the entertainment stuff and a little bit of the PR-ish kind of stuff. Yeah. And give it to people who normally never get that, like executives and engineers. They never get those rhetorical resources in their bios or in their public persona. And they feel like it's cheesy, like it's too much.
Yeah.
It goes too far. Like, your bio on your website is awesome, extremely well written, and has so much information. That's why we were talking at the beginning about you've done so many things, and it's all in there in that bio. But it doesn't feel crowded, you know.
Well, the big lesson, I'd say, the big sad lesson I've learned in my career is that the price of being interested in many, many things, and you're right, I'm interested in a million things, is that it makes it harder to sell yourself. It's like, oh, he's a playwright. Oh, he's a speechwriter. Oh, he's a professor. Oh, you know, he's a floor wax. He's a salad topping, whatever it was. And for a long time, my way to try to make a living was to say, oh, look at all these things I can do. Well, nobody wants that guy. They want a guy who can nail down the floor, whatever it is. That's what they want. And that is so hard for me because we come back to where we began, which is joy. The joy for me is like, I wonder what I get to do today.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to sell. But it turns out that's only fun for me. What they want to know is, can you write this speech? I'll pay you what you need, and I need it by next Thursday. Just tell me how much it is, and I'll do it. They want that. And that to me is like, I love having that work. It's fun to do. But what's more fun is getting to it.
Yeah, and I think that's a good insight. I think there's a lot of variety people in the world, you know, like, and it Steve doesn't Allen, fit.
He's a big guy that I really admired was Steve Allen, because, you know, he wrote a song every day. He was smart. He could do all these things.
Yeah, and a job like a talk show host can handle that, you know, because you have people coming through and there's variety in the show, and you can do songs, you can do comedy, you can do a little acting and all that kind of stuff. It is hard to find a job in the world that wants variety.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to ask one more thing to you, because I love talking to comedy with somebody who's thought about it seriously. I just want to hear you talk about Letterman and his influence. I just to lay it out, I think he's one of the most important figures of the 20th century in culture, actually. And I think that we live in Dave's world. I wrote a piece for National Review actually about Letterman when he retired. And I think we live in Dave's world. I think the language we use, the attitude we have, the distance we assume flowed from Letterman and a few select writers. I want to know if I'm alone in that, what you think about Letterman, because to me, he's a god.
Yeah, I agree with the god status for Letterman. I do. I think so. I wrote for the Late Late Show, which is the show he owns that's on after his show. And then I was a distance writer for him after I left that show for about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, which was hard because I was living in Texas. And I was thinking about this earlier he had started picking up the structure of telling a joke and then having a visual repunch uh-huh. of it. And you have to kind of be there to do all that stuff. You have to know what the graphics are. You have to, you know, so I got some jokes on the show, but after a while, it just wasn't worth it. You know, he was still paying his original rates, like $75 a joke. And I'm like, dude, I worked on this thing. But it was super fascinating. I remember the first time after I would sit and write the jokes in the morning and text and send them in. And then I'd record the show. And I remember sitting at breakfast with my kids who are like 10 and 7 and watching the tape of this show back when you had to videotape. Mm-hmm. And Letterman opened and closed with one of my jokes.
Oh, nice.
And hearing the words I'd written that morning at the kitchen table come out of that guy's face, you know, in New York at that, I guess he was in LA by that time. I didn't go to LA, did he? New York.
No, so, I was always in New York.
Yeah. And so our show was in LA. To hear it, it was like just this crazy disjunctive moment of, that guy is like the thing I've grown up on.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, to get to your question, what Letterman was able to do is take this massive cultural energy of what the counterculture was, which was to separate itself from the main culture, right? That's the whole mm-hmm. definition. No matter how you do it, with drugs or free love or anti this or whatever, you are separating from the mothership. And he was like the bridge back to the mothership, I think, for most countercultures and pop culture is comedy.
Yeah.
And he built that bridge. He was like, oh yeah, I'm over here. I can criticize corporations and everything else, but I'm going to do it with a way that can make people still in the corporations kind of laugh and the people outside really laugh. And there's enough, you know, entertainment, capitalism value in comedy that they can sell it.
Yeah.
And so they let him do it right in front of everybody.
Yeah.
So he was the first guy the first magician to take all of that magic in those cultures and bring it up and sell it to us on TV, and just a master at it.
There are so many things to say about him. I have something else I want to ask you about too. One of the things Letterman, I think there's a moment that summarizes everything good about Letterman is they did a little funny video for Paul Schaefer, who wrote a song called Dress Cool, where they would, and in the video for it, the guys would be in their ordinary clothes, each of the members of the band, and they would step into a dressing room, and they would step out of the dressing room in some wild outfit. And then they have Dave, and he's in a button-down suit. He steps into the dressing room, and then he steps out of the dress room exactly the same. And that, to me, that's, if you want to understand Letterman's thing, is like, and just the same goofy gap tooth look on his face, just zip. The other thing is, can you talk about Craig Kilborn, who I think is the greatest forgotten comic guy in history? I understand that maybe he wasn't the most pleasant person in the world, but I think of his stuff like Asexual Icon and his five questions thing he brought from ESPN. To me, that's the guy that I missed the most in late night after Letterman. He was only there 5 years and then he just disappeared, but I would never miss Kilborn.
Yeah, Kilborn, that show had great writers.
Oh, I mean, it was great.
Everybody that wrote for that show has gone on to do interesting things in Hollywood. Mike Gibbons, who's the head writer, had a sitcom for a while and has done a bunch of things. He founded or created Tosh.0, you know.
Daniel Tosh. See, there's another guy I think is at the top of the heap. I love him.
And Gibbons is one of those guys that has that kind of more acerbic, ironic voice. And it fuels a lot of stuff. You see it float over into, like, you know, the Comedy Store and, you know, that kind of harsher, you know, like you talk about, you know, all those guys, Louis C.K., all of them, the harsher vibe guys. And Gibbons is able to capture that and do it in the background on TV shows. And so a lot of what you saw on Kilborn was Gibbons, you know, sort of articulating that acerbic that Kilborn loved.
Yeah.
I didn't know Craig very well personally. I can't say whether he was a nice person or not. He was somewhat aloof and a little, you know, not engaging. But I thought for the things that you need to be able to do really well, he was really gifted at it. The guy could handle a joke when you gave him a good joke, and he could kind of act a little bit and stuff like that. Like that Asexual Icon, I'm trying to remember the name of that. I loved writing that thing.
Oh, there you go. Now my hat's off to you. I would love that.
I didn't create it, but it's like we had joke baskets on that show, and like every once in a while we'd be just, what are we going to do today? And like, oh, we'll do I can't remember the name of it, but like I remember one of the jokes I wrote was, you know, it's sad when your physician during your annual physical openly weeps. He just kill it every time. There was a lot of great stuff on that show. Like Kilborn kind of, you know, flamed out and people ended up not liking him. And I think he made a mistake leaving late night.
I made it. He could have been, but he was everything to me. He was so naturally right there in the, it was like, and now Letterman continues with a different host. And he was this, somehow he made that, he was that total frat boy thing, but you didn't resent, at least I didn't. I thought you're kind of cool because you're kind of a dick. And yeah. I like that.
Well, and that is a comic character. That's what I say. It's a little more acerbic. It's a little more haughty than Letterman. But Letterman has all that. Just Letterman knows how to soften it. And yeah. Kilborn wouldn't soften it, you know. And yes. Ultimately, I think that's a mistake. I think not letting people like you, you know, like you can be a douche on camera and as your public persona. But watch all the shock comics. Watch Sam Kinison. Watch all these guys, edgy comics. They smile all the time.
Yeah.
The entire time they're doing their show, because they have to let you in. They have to show, hey, I'm talking shit about people, but I'm not talking about you, man. You know, we're
Well, Dave changed when he went from 12:30 to 11:30. Dave completely. I thought that was a big change. And I thought, I remember when late night was over and it became late show. And I remember watching the last couple episodes and I thought, we'll never see this again. And it was funny. The new one was funny, but come on.
It wasn't the same thing. He went from counterculture to mainstream culture. Like he went from taking shots at corporations, like the thing with Bryant Gumbel and, like, you know, the bullhorn at NBC and General Electric and stuff like that, to taking shots down at, like, and he wouldn't take hard shots, but now he was making fun of people on the street and shit like that. And I'm like, yeah, come on. I want to see my counterculture genius going after important targets. And he just gave it up. He's like, nah, I'm just going to be fun. I'm just going to be fun and funny. And, you know, I'll take shots at whatever, you know, goofy people are around. It wasn't as, to me, it lost its importance at that point. It didn't lose its entertainment, but it lost its importance.
Right. He wasn't afraid of utter absurdity. I remember one night the show was over and ended a couple minutes early. And then he walked to the middle of the stage where there was a where there was a spiral staircase. You probably remember this. You're smiling. He walks to the spiral staircase. He walks up, and it opens into the hull of a ship. And he tells Paul good night, and they climb into separate hammocks and they go to sleep. Yeah. As you hear seagulls in the background, that was the whole thing. It was just this kind of crazy stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff. I love that comedy. I love comedy of the absurd. I love very thin comedy, and he's so quick. Best interviewer ever. You know, just gifted. And
we've gotten to live through a true golden age of comedy, you and I. We've gotten to see as good as it has ever been, I think.
Yeah, I think the nice thing about comedy is it just resurrects itself in new people all the time. I just see it over and over again. And even here in Austin, you know, there's probably, I don't know, 400, 500 people who do stand-up around here on a amateur level. Mm-hmm. And I don't go out that much because it's so clogged, you know, by the amateur world. But it's fascinating. And out of them, every time I go out, I'll see somebody where I'm like, wow, that's really interesting. Not that they'll capture it, not that they could move it into professional, you know, level, or, you know, that they might have that energy, but there's always some kind of comedy hook in there. And I'm like, oh, I would love to work with that hook, that one thing in you. But yeah, comedy just, it just comes back up into people. Like, they're born with it.
We've talked about so many funny people, and I want to mention our mutual friend. I don't know how well you know Cody Marley.
I love Cody. I've known Cody forever.
Cody, good Lord. It's just,
talk about absurdity.
Oh, and his whole life, he's like Andy Kaufman reborn. It's just, you go to his Facebook page or whatever, and it's just like, is he serious? Is he really doing this? I think he is. Nobody makes me laugh like Cody Marley does. It's just, he's like fearless to the point of doesn't care. I love that stuff.
Yeah. I don't think he understands fear.
I don't think he does either. I've rarely seen him afraid. I saw him afraid in an elevator in Las Vegas one night, but that's it.
He opened for me once just randomly at Swanix Marine, as a Marine base in North Carolina. He had a club called Swanix. And this place was amazing. It was a museum to the Marines. I think it was Marines. And like the owner was a former Marine, lifetime Marine. And he had just like every piece of memorabilia and like outfit from every era of the Marines. And it was like a museum. And he had stand up in there. And so one of his rules, you had to wear a suit, or you had to tie in a suit jacket, something like that. And I walked into my black t-shirt and he's like, you can't perform. I'm like, well, I'm the headliner. You're going to have a 45 minute space where it's going to get kind of boring, you know? And so he let me go up anyway, but Cody just randomly got booked to open. I'm not sure I've ever seen somebody so hated or stared at. Like he did his thing. He did a thing about Jesus playing football, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
They're like,
just a blitzing Buddha. Yeah. I know that bit. Yeah.
They had no ability to react to him. It was so far afield from their expectation.
Oh,
there's guys like that. You talk about Letterman and hearing that comedy vibe, living at that comedy, you know, resonance. It's just fascinating to me. I've always loved it. And when you find it in people, I'll just listen to it all day long.
All this makes me want to get back up and do 5 minutes. Man, that's awesome.
Yeah, I miss live stand-up. It's nothing else quite like it. Doesn't have that energy. Yeah. Well, Mike, we are over an hour. I'm going to come back and talk to you again because I'm having so much fun. Anything you'd like to promote or push, like your courses or books or anything you want people to go buy?
You know, if you want to know more about me, visit MikeLongOnline.com. I'll wear you out over there. If you're interested in learning some things about writing, you can go to the promagicshow.com. So there you go. MikeLongOnline.com and promagicshow.com.
Yeah. I think we have a lot of similar backgrounds and interests. Like we've worked the same minds, even though like we've passed different shafts, you know, different coal that we're trying to pull out. But like, I always fascinated when I find somebody else who's like kind of been attached to the word, you know, their whole life, and found ways to make a living with it and all the different things that it pulls you into around in the world. So it's been, super fun talking to you.
You too, buddy. This is great. It makes me tragically regretful of all the conversations we haven't had. But there you go.
Yeah, well, you know, we're still here. We still got time. We'll still talk.
We'll be fine. We'll drag Lawrence and Cody in. We'll have a big we'll have a foursome of some kind.
Yeah, I've thought about that recently, about trying to do a crowd. I'm going to do probably a little show with that might just be the comedy writers, like, you know, because they're such, I wish people would know the engines, you know, underneath the Titanic that is comedy, because they're minds down there that you have never heard.
Is there any better place to be in a comedy club than the green room while the headliner's up and nobody exactly likes the headliner?
Oh my God.
Is that the best place to be in the world?
It's just like these little mental wolverines that are just, you know, just chit. It's like, you can't predict it. You know, I love it. So, well, super fun, Mike. I appreciate it. Everybody, go to rhetoricwarriors.com, check out a course. I'm getting ready to release a new course and a book. Be my first book that I've done since my dissertation. Could come back and listen again. We are the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. And just remember, you know, great persuasion is kind of useful in the world. So let's get out there and learn it. Thanks, Mike.
Cool.